Hello, welcome once again to Leto's Law. I'm Steve Leto. Today we're going to talk about one of the most famous trials in American history, the Scopes Monkey Trial. Everyone gets taught about this in school. We've all heard of this case. But it's interesting because many people were not ever told, or it was never taught to us, that the entire thing was a big publicity stunt. It was a trial. It was a real trial. But the entire thing was a publicity stunt. And as far as publicity stunts go, it's probably one of the most successful publicity stunts in American history. So the Scopes Monkey Trial, it has some serious issues underneath it, but you have to understand how it came about. So what we're talking about is that in Tennessee in 1925, a man was put on trial for teaching evolution against the law of the land at the time. And it was a huge event. So we'll talk about that and how it came about. But what happened was in the 1920s, there was a big argument brought about whether or not we should teach evolution in schools. And there's a large group of people who thought that teaching evolution was somehow anti-biblical. And therefore, they postured the argument as you're either for evolution and against the Bible, or you're for the Bible and against evolution, and you cannot possibly reconcile the two. So Tennessee passed what was called the Butler Act. And in 1925, the Tennessee House of Representatives was offered a bill by John W. Butler making teaching evolution a misdemeanor. The so-called Butler Act was passed 6 days later, almost unanimously, with no amendments. And so when the ACLU, which was a young organization at the time, received news of the bill's passage, they immediately sent out a press release offering to challenge the Butler Act. If anybody got arrested for teaching evolution in Tennessee, the ACLU said, we will provide a free defense to anybody who gets arrested for this. So here's the funny part. At Fred Robinson's drugstore in Dayton, Tennessee, George Rapelier, I could be mispronouncing his name and I apologize, a 31-year-old from New York who was a local coal company manager, came to the drugstore with a copy of the paper containing the ACLU offer and said, in essence, that this was a great way that the town leaders could put Dayton on the map because Dayton's population had been falling recently and had been as high as 3,000 just 20 years earlier, but was now just 1,800. So they agreed, you know, the drugstores where all the bigwigs in town met, and they agreed that, yeah, let's put on a trial. Let's put on a trial and see how much attention we can get. They probably had no idea how much attention they were going to get for this. They contacted John Scopes, who's a 24-year-old general science teacher and part-time football coach, and they brought him to the drugstore. And Scopes later described the meeting where he was asked, John, we've been arguing, and I said nobody could teach biology without teaching some evolution. Scopes said, yeah, that's right. And he pulled a copy of Hunter's Civic Biology off of a shelf in the drugstore because the drugstore also sold textbooks. And Rapelier said, you've been teaching him this book? And Scopes replied that while filling in for the regular biology teacher during an illness, he had, in fact, assigned readings on evolution from that textbook. So Rapelier said, well, you know, then you've been violating the law. And asked him, would you be willing to stand for a test case? And Scopes agreed. And later he explained his decision, the best time to scotch the snake is when it starts to wiggle. I'm sure we've all heard that before. Herbert and Sue Hicks, two local attorneys and friends of Scopes, agreed to prosecute. But things got out of hand at that point, and it became larger than life in every possible way. So, a preliminary hearing on May 9, 1925, officially held Scopes for trial by the grand jury, but then they released him and did not require him to post bond. Apparently, he wasn't a threat to community because all he's going to do was teach evolution, which, by the way, he didn't normally teach. He only taught it when he was filling in for other people. But meanwhile, here's what happened. So the ACLU is going to get asked to come in and defend this guy. And William Jennings Bryan was a three-time presidential nominee. He was extremely well-known, but he'd never been elected president, obviously. So he agreed to prosecute the case. And this is an interesting thing that should have caused a lot of red flags to go up. And people are saying, wait, is this thing serious or not? When out-of-state famous people offer to prosecute and defend the case in your state, something's out of whack, because normally you'd have a local prosecutor and then you'd hire an attorney from the state bar to defend, right? Nah, that's not how we're going to do it here. The Scopes Monkey Trial is going to be different. The politician, William Jennings Bryan, was already well known as an anti-evolution activist, and he was basically making this a national controversy over whether or not you could teach evolution and still believe in the Bible. And he'd basically broken it into this binary proposition. Either you supported the Bible or you supported evolution, but you couldn't do both. And in his mind, the evolutionary folk were atheists and the good people were Bible believers, and there was no possibility that you could believe in both. So when they realized that William Jennings Bryan was going to come in and defend, somebody goes, hey, we need to get a good, he's going to be the prosecutor. We need to get a good defense guy in here. Who can we get? Somebody actually proposed H.G. Wells, the science fiction writer, and asked him if he wanted to come in and defend the case, because as well as being a science fiction writer, maybe he knows something about science. H.G. Wells turned down the offer, but Clarence Darrow, and here's the thing, in American history, Clarence Darrow is probably the most well-known defense attorney who ever lived, and he'll probably go down in history for that forever. I've read his biography, I've read all about him, I've read many of his cases, and for his time, there's no question that there was no one who came close to him with his abilities in defending a case. So Clarence Darrow, in fact, had recently acted for the defense in the notorious Leopold and Loeb murder trial, and he'd heard about the Scopes trial from journalist H.L. Mencken, who had suggested that Darrow should defend Scopes. And Darrow actually turned it down at first and said, look, guys, I'm getting ready to retire here. I'm getting tired. I want to just rest. And when he heard that William Jennings Bryan was going to be prosecuting, he changed his mind very quickly because turns out these guys didn't like each other. And it's going to be a great opportunity. It's one last fight in public and in trial. These guys had apparently sniped at each other in public over the years. But there's no better way for an attorney to go to battle against another attorney than in a courtroom. So that's what they're going to do. So Darrow and Bryan had been butting heads for years. Darrow's goal in getting involved was to debunk fundamentalist Christianity and raise awareness of a narrow fundamentalist interpretation of the Bible. And this is, they think, the only time in Darrow's career where he offered to defend somebody for free. He'll defend you. It's going to cost you, except for this one time. So, Bryan and Darrow set the tone by immediately attacking each other in the press. The ACLU attempted to remove Darrow from the case because they actually wanted to try the case on its merits. Darrow's like, you guys, get out of here. This is mine now. So, the grand jury met on May 9th, 1925. In preparations, Scopes actually recruited and coached students to testify against him. That's 3 of the 7 students who were attending were called to testify, and each showed a sketchy understanding of evolution, which was enough. And the case was pushed forward and set a trial for a date of July 10th, 1925. Bryan arrived in Dayton 3 days before the trial, and he got off the train, and it was a circus. It was a zoo. It was just pandemonium. He was a national figure. He was extremely well known. He was well liked. And the press understood this was going to be a spectacle. The press probably outnumbered everybody else in town. Bryan posed for photo ops. He gave a couple public speeches. And he stated his intention was not just to defend the anti-evolution law, but to use the trial to debunk evolution itself. Darrow got there the day before the trial to little fanfare, but that's going to change. So the trial day started with crowds pouring into the courthouse 2 hours before scheduled start. The courtroom was packed. The courthouse was packed. There was people standing in the hallways. And when Bryan entered the courtroom, there was applause. And then when Bryan and Darrow shook hands, there was more applause. And this is one of those situations where you know that the judge is looking at this going, are we having a trial here? Are we putting on a show? Is this a reality show? What is this? And remember, this is before television existed. Okay. Now, radio existed and radio would play into this. But, I mean, again, this is one of those things where it's everyone there probably realized it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to watch something like this happen. So first of all, to start the trial, what do? They pray. They don't start trials anymore with prayers, but apparently in 1925 in Tennessee, they did. They brought out, on the first day of trial, much of the testimony that Scopes' students had given at the grand jury. They also did a jury selection. And meanwhile, out in front of the courthouse, there were barbecues, concessions, carnival games, and that did die down when the trial was not taking place. But whenever the trial was not taking place, Brian and Darryl were speaking to the press, again, sniping at each other, bickering, calling each other names, and accusing the other side of you know, being dunderheaded, which I think is a common term back then. So on Monday, arguments began, and by the defense, working to establish the scientific validity of evolution. And the prosecution focused on the Butler Act as an education standard, basically saying, hey, look, the state's got the right to set standards as to what gets taught. But the problem, of course, is that if you're on the other side, and Darryl is not arguing the little minutiae of the law, but he's arguing the big picture, how long can you prosecute that case before you say, you know something, pull out the stops, let's fight big picture stuff too? So Darryl responded by laying out the case in an aggressive way, part of a strategy related to the defense, planning to waive their closing arguments. They're like, you know, Darryl is famous for stuff like that. So people say that the statement that Darryl made at the opening of the case is considered an example of his best passionate public speaking. And his chief argument was the Butler Act promoted one particular religious view and was therefore illegal. His opening statement was 2 hours, and I'm here to tell you that's probably short for him. Clarence Darryl is famous for lengthy orations, hours and hours and hours. Nowadays, I've taught trial practice. They will tell you in a trial practice class that you don't do a 2 or 3 hour opening statement. You don't do a 2 or 3 hour closing argument. In most cases, the average person's attention span is 15 to 20 minutes. And most good stories can be done in 15 to 20 minutes. And so when a guy is up there for 2 hours, that's old style. Because back then they weren't competing with things like iPads and YouTube and, you know, iPods and Kindle readers and so on. Back then people didn't mind sitting there with a fan in a boiling hot courtroom listening to William Jennings Bryan or Clarence Darryl pontificate for a couple hours. That was considered good entertainment back then. But again, his 2 hour statement was considered short by his own standards. The trial began on Wednesday. And they had opening statements, witnesses followed, and pretty quickly they established that Scopes had in fact taught evolution. A zoologist named Maynard Metcalf gave expert testimony about the science of evolution, and they were then beginning to wonder whether Scopes himself may or may not take the stand. Subsequent days saw prosecutors arguing the validity of using expert witnesses, and this provided Brian with the opportunity for an extended speech on the subject, which of course the crowd ate up. Defense attorney Dudley Field Malone, who was helping Darryl, then countered with a speech of his own and received a thunderous standing ovation. The next day, the judge ruled that experts on the stands could be cross-examined, and nowadays you'd get to do that anyways, but back then it was a question. And so Darryl came up with the brilliant idea of calling Brian to the stand as a witness. Extremely unusual. You cannot normally call the opposing counsel as a witness, because normally they've got nothing to testify to. But when your opponent is a blowhard who considers himself an expert on the Bible, and you want to put an expert on the stand and pick him apart about the Bible, what better person than him? So guess what? Darryl called Brian to the stand, and everyone was in an uproar. But Brian agreed to do it and put himself on the stand and let Darryl cross-examine him on the Bible. Darryl interrogated him on interpreting the Bible literally, which undercut his earlier sweeping religious speeches. It also cornered him into admitting that he didn't know much about science, since the Bible doesn't actually address a lot of science. And when the judge ruled that Brian's testimony should be stricken from the record, Darryl suggested that to save time, his client should then just be found guilty. But the damage is already done. You can't strike all the stuff from the... I mean, you can strike it, technically, but ask the jury to forget what they heard. So Darryl actually said, you know something? Let's skip closing arguments, just find my guy guilty, which they did. And so all people remembered from the trial was a whole lot of brouhaha And then Brian getting on the stand, being cross-examined by Darrow, and most people who were there go, that was not a fair fight because Darrow outclassed the guy horribly. The jury took 9 minutes to pronounce Scopes guilty, who's fined $100. After the trial, Brian immediately began to prepare his unused closing statement as a speech for his rallies, and he never got to use the speech because he died in his sleep a week later. And in fact, he died in Dayton. Brian never actually got to leave Dayton and go outside Dayton and talk. So both sides of the case claimed victory. The Butler Act was actually upheld, though, and the anti-evolution movement continued. Mississippi passed a similar law months later, and there were a few more states that passed laws on this. In fact, 22 other states made similar efforts, but were defeated. So it went back and forth. And the controversy, of course, simmers till today because they are now talking about whether intelligent design can be taught and so on and so forth. But all anybody remembers about the monkey trial is that, number one, is made into a play, Inherit the Wind, and it's made into a movie. And the movie, of course, was a blockbuster. And everyone remembers this huge fight over such a seemingly small infraction that the man was fined $100 and he's found guilty. And yet the guy had the two biggest names in America arguing for him and against him. And the news coverage was insane. There were actually people in town who were using modern technology at that time to get it broadcast in different parts of the country. And there was journalists from all around the world covering the trial. And so the people who put this little stunt together won. They got what they wanted. They got Dayton, Tennessee put on the map because of this trial. And it's one of those things that when the dust settles and everybody leaves, guess what? It's the only thing Dayton, Tennessee is apparently known for, is it was where the Scopes monkey trial took place. But again, for the PR people, the people who study viral marketing, you got to understand, that's how you do it, my friends. You find a silly law that gets passed. You find somebody who's willing to stand up and say they did it. And then you see if you can't get the two biggest names in the country to come in and fight over it for you all the time, you know, selling tickets in essence to watch what's happening. So that's what happened with the Scopes monkey trial. He got fined $100, but that's not the point. The point is it was a huge successful publicity stunt. Questions or comments, put them below. Otherwise, talk to you later. Bye-bye.